This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
These guys are defending their business model at any cost, even though their business model essentially calls for the planet to heat beyond the level where scientists have told us it's safe or even plausible to imagine.
Bill McKibben is one of the world's leading environmentalists. In addition to his recent success leading a coalition to stop the construction against the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, McKibben heads 350.org, an international organization dedicated to raising awareness of global warming. This week on Sea Change Radio, I talk with McKibben about the struggle to stop the pipeline, the impact of the Citizens United ruling on the environmental movement, and what's on the horizon for him and his fellow green advocates. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Bill McKibben. He is a author and environmentalist. Bill, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Very good to be with you, Alex.
Since you were on Sea Change Radio last, when you were speaking with Bill Bowie 3 years ago about civil disobedience against the coal industry, your advocacy has shifted to the Keystone XL pipeline and with some great success. Why don't you first just review a little bit of some of the progress that you and your colleagues have had in preventing the pipeline up to now.
Well, sure. Let me say first that at 350.org, we work on 100 different things at once because we're active in every country in the world but North Korea. So, you know, it's been a good year of working on coal plants in Kosovo and South Africa and on subsidies in half the countries in the world for the fossil fuel industry and on and on. But in North America, you're right, the big fight this year was over this proposed pipeline from the tar sands of northern Alberta down to the Gulf of Mexico. It's an important fight for a number of reasons, including the fact that those tar sands are the second biggest pool of carbon on the planet. If you could somehow torch them all overnight, which thank God you can't, but if you could, you'd raise the carbon concentration of the atmosphere from its current 390 parts per million, already too high, to about 540 parts per million, you know, off the edge of disaster. So this was a crucial fight, one of many crucial fights, you know, no more important than stopping coal export to the rest of the world or that sort of thing. But because the president himself would have to make a decision, it was a fight in which we thought we had some room to make a statement. And that's what we did our best to do. A few of us, I wrote a letter in the early summer last year, and then a few of my friends and colleagues signed it, some of our indigenous leaders who really had taken this fight from the beginning. Some of the farmers and ranchers and things in the Midwest, and then people like Wendell Berry and Naomi Klein. And we asked people if they'd come to Washington in late summer and commit civil disobedience. We didn't know what to expect. As it turned out, it went well. It was the largest civil disobedience action in 30 years in this country. 1,253 people were arrested. I got to spend 3 days in Central Cell Block in Washington, D.C., which was about as much fun as it sounds like it might be. But the upshot was that we kind of used our bodies to ante into this game. And once anteed in, we did our best to play it out, following the president around the country and then rallying people in a huge gathering outside his house. At 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in November, we managed to circle the place five deep with people. And 4 days later, the president blocked, at least temporarily, approval of the pipeline. Congress, which is, as you know, owned in large part by the oil companies, did their best to reinstate it and passed a series of, or tried to pass a series of resolutions mandating approval of the pipeline. But for the moment anyway, those have failed. We won the last big test in the Senate in early March by 2 votes. And so for the moment, though TransCanada will doubtless reapply for the pipeline and there'll be a decision some point further down the road and things, for the moment, that pipeline isn't getting built. Temporary victories are the only kind that environmentalists win. And this by no means stops global warming. On the other hand, it was kind of sweet. As late as November, when the National Journal polled 300, quote, energy insiders, unquote, in Washington, all the people on the Hill and the lobbyists and things, 97% of them said that this pipeline would, in fact, be approved. TransCanada was so confident that they have put hundreds of millions of dollars worth of pipe on fields across the Midwest just waiting for the go-ahead, which they thought would come last fall, to build their pipeline. So this is one of the very few times when the fossil fuel industry, when big oil has taken a loss, and they did it not because we raised more money than they did, we certainly did not, because we found different currencies to work in, passion, spirit, creativity. As I say, we spent our bodies at least for a few days, and all of that probably gives us some signs about how we should think about these things going forward.
Yes, you write in the March Orion magazine that it took the actions of odd and unreasonable actual people willing to go to jail for the cause. But explain to people who may not be familiar with the Keystone Pipeline's unique attributes why this is different than the hundreds of other pipelines that dot our planet.
For people along the route, the pipeline, you know, would cross 6 states across the middle of the country, and you know, it goes over the Oglala Aquifer, and it's carrying this low grade of oil, diluted bitumen, they call it, which is very abrasive, and hence the risk of leak is great. There were 12 spills in the first 12 months of the operation of the kind of smaller precursor pipeline. So all of those are important. But the real reason that this pipeline is so important from our point of view is that it connects to this huge carbon bomb up there in northern Alberta. We've got to leave that oil in the ground, just like we've got to leave the Amazon, you know, standing. And we've got to leave our coal fields of Wyoming and Montana underground. And we just cannot keep pouring carbon into the atmosphere. We're already overloaded.
If you weren't focusing on Keystone this last year, where do you think your energies would have been more focused?
You know, for environmentalists, the biggest problems are, you know, have to do with, at the moment, with global warming and with carbon. They're the runaway problem that we have to get under control immediately. We may already have waited too long, but we're hoping that we can't stop climate change, but at least we can keep it from getting worse than it needs to be. So when you look at what causes it, you know, the battles get pretty easy. It's coal and gas and oil. So we're heavily involved in all three areas. We're doing our best, for instance, to stop coal export ports being built on the Pacific coast. I was out in Bellingham, Washington, and places like that, doing what I could to help rally support. We're trying hard to slow down and stop fracking in the east coast of the United States, especially where the Marcellus Shale has gotten a lot of attention. So we've been working with friends like Josh Fox and Mark Ruffalo to slow things down. And with a little bit of success, the Delaware River Basin Commission, just a few days after our tar sands decision, they decided not to give the green light for more fracking along the Delaware River, which was good news. And New York State maintains its moratorium. And with oil, you know, we take on things like Keystone whenever we can. But it's, you know, no use pretending that we're going to stop global warming one pipeline or one port at a time. We won't. We'll stop it if and when we get what all the economists have been talking about for a long time, a serious price on carbon that really pushes the shift to renewable energy fast, fast, fast. And that we'll get when we're able to politically match the power of the fossil fuel industry. So all our work is also geared toward movement building, toward moving and building a movement big enough that, you know, Exxon et al. Need to pay some attention to us. And Keystone was at least a small step in that direction.
What do you attribute the success of, the Keystone movement to mostly?
Strong long-term leadership, especially from the indigenous community who really started this fight, and then from people along the pipeline route, people like Jane Klebb at Bold, Nebraska. So, and, you know, people in the Indigenous Environmental Network, people like Tom Goldtooth and Clayton Thomas Mueller and people like that who really were there from day one.
Was it more boots on the ground or was it more internet-built coalitions?
No, it was, it's people deeply involved. I mean, we use the internet, but we use it to do things in real life. Strong unity among big environmental groups, that helped once the fight got going. The day after I get out of jail, happily, the CEOs of all the major green groups in Washington, from the most conservative to the most militant, published a joint letter to the president saying there's not an inch of daylight between our position and those of the people getting arrested in front of your house. And then they really made good on it. You know, this fight in Congress this year, once it moved sort of into the corridors of Congress, it's groups like NRDC and the Sierra Club and the National Wildlife Federation and the League of Conservation Voters that have been doing tons of the heavy lifting to make sure that the victory was preserved. But the thing that catalyzed it was clearly having people willing to go put their bodies on the line. It's not a tool that environmentalists have used particularly effectively in a long time, and I'm glad we were able to rehabilitate it a little bit. We did it carefully, and we said that everybody who came was going to, wanted to come get arrested. We wanted you in your Sunday best. We wanted a way to demonstrate publicly that we weren't the radicals in this fight, that the radicals work for oil companies, that they're willing to change the chemical composition of the atmosphere, which is the most radical thing that I think humans have ever contemplated. So we did it in a particular way, and it was pretty successful. I'm a radical.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with environmentalist Bill McKibben. You mentioned earlier how you had to kind of trade in different currencies than what corporations would typically do.
We're never going to have the money to match those guys. That's the thing.
And with that in mind, you have different arrows in your quiver that you can use to get your job done. You wrote recently, though, about just the basic concept of the corporation is the crucial job of our time, is to somehow rein these corporations in. And you write about Citizens United kind of giving a whole new platform for these corporations. But I was fascinated by how you mentioned the simplicity of the corporation itself is what leads us into trouble. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court has ruled that corporations are to be counted as people, which has a large number of practical problems related to their, you know, ability then to spend unlimited amounts of money on campaigns and things like that, all of which we need to take very seriously. But we also, I'm a writer, so I take seriously words, and I think it's important to remind ourselves that corporations are not, in fact, people. people are very, very complicated. We have, base instincts which drive us towards acquisition and, self-aggrandizement. But we also have all kinds of countervailing forces. We, can remember our grandparents and we can imagine our great-grandchildren. We have art and we have religion and we have many other kind of forces that sometimes bring us to do things that surprise even ourselves, to act against our interests. None of those things are true of corporations. They're remarkably simple. They're closer to kind of single-celled organisms that will move, if you put them on the petri dish in the direction of the sugar at the edge. That's why they're effective. If you want to get done the things that corporations do well, then it's a very good model. You just shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that they have something to do with people, that they're complicated enough for us to value their opinions and things in the same way.
You wrote that corporations are like single-celled flagellates. And it seems to me that this simplicity of the corporation itself leads us, their simplicity of just profits, that's what their mandates are. The simplicity of that idea itself can really get us into trouble when we start encountering these more complex ideas like how to stop the planet from overheating.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, look, the major coal, gas, and oil companies now have about five times as much carbon in their reserves as the scientists say is safe to burn if we have any chance of staying below 2 degrees Celsius increase in temperature. They're every one of their instincts calls for them to go ahead and burn that oil, that coal, that gas. And the only way they'll won't do it is if we stop them from doing it. There's nothing self-limiting in their behavior in that way, the way that there is in human beings. We need a price on carbon to steer them in the correct directions. Exxon's perfectly capable of being an energy company instead of an oil company and of making probably large, even obscene amounts of money putting up solar panels or windmills or whatever it is. But we need public policy that steers them in that direction. And at the moment, we can't get it because their political power is so strong that it blocks every approach.
You mentioned how you went to jail this last summer. Have you encountered any corporate scare tactics behind the scenes, some less public? We always hear about these very large corporations. You're at the head of a pretty powerful movement. Anything that you could share with us without naming names?
No. Look, it's been a tough fight over Keystone, and it's clear that they've been strongly on the other side and spending tons of money to do it. I don't think they're going to come, beat me up or something. The thing that we worry about and we see is their incredible ability to take their money and use it to garner political power. So that's why wins like the one we had are rare. And frankly, it shouldn't have been all that hard as it was to block this pipeline. The country's foremost climatologist, Jim Hansen at NASA, said in June that if we tap heavily into the tar sands, it would be, quote, essentially game over, unquote, for the climate. At that point, reasonable policymakers should have said, okay, that's a poor idea. Let's find something else to do. But they didn't, and the reason above all that they didn't is the financial and hence political power of that industry.
So corporate scare tactics really can't work also because your movement is so diffused as well. They'd be playing whack-a-mole. It's not about getting Bill McKibben. It's about right and wrong.
Yeah, well, and I'm not, by any means important to this whole thing. That's right. It's not that there's like some huge conspiracy going on behind the scenes. Everything's wide out in the open. I mean, these guys are defending their business model at any cost, even though their business model essentially calls for the planet to heat beyond the level where scientists have told us it's safe or even plausible to imagine.
But while there is a lot in the open for those who want to seek out math and facts. There's a huge doublespeak campaign always underway, whether it be for perpetuating oil and gas subsidies or trying to get the Keystone Pipeline built. We constantly hear from the other side about jobs being created by this pipeline. Why don't you spell out the realities of this?
And of course, all this work that began with the kind of stuff around carbon, I mean, we found out lots of other things, including the fact that the industry was not telling the truth about any number of things. One of the arguments was that this would be a jobs creation program. If you think about it for a little while, that's unlikely. The reason you build a pipeline really is so that you won't have to employ anybody to work on it. And in fact, they've now conceded that the permanent jobs created by the pipeline will number in the hundreds, probably low hundreds, they think. For all the states across which the pipeline runs, it'll provide about 20 permanent jobs. There'll be some jobs in the year and a half or two that it takes to build it. But at first, people were citing completely ludicrous numbers. It'll create 200,000 jobs or 2 million jobs. The actual number of two-year temporary jobs is more on the order of 2,500. Now, those aren't to be sneezed at. That's, 2,500 people who'd have worked for a couple of years who might not have it otherwise. But it's a very different calculation than 20,000 or 200,000 jobs. And, of course, once economists really began to look at it, they began to figure out that you were putting far more jobs than that at risk. Cornell released a report just this past, earlier this month, saying the number of jobs you're putting at risk in the event of a spill are enormous because there's so many agricultural and tourism workers along the course of that pipeline that no rational actor would do this. As usual, it's an effort to get enormous private benefit, the money from that oil flowing through that pipeline, while transposing all the risks, the climate's not even a risk, a guarantee, and the spill risk onto the public. And that's really a lousy thing to do.
Yes, you wrote that there's a tendency at every important but difficult crossroad to pretend that it's not really there. And some of these facts kind of bring that to mind when I read about the misinformation campaign going on with the pipeline.
Yeah, it was a very, continues to be a very strong misinformation campaign. And we don't obviously have the money to take out the TV commercials, to counter theirs or whatever. But it must be said that we do live in an age when the internet provides the ability to get information around. And I think many people do understand what a poor idea this thing now was. And that's a good sign. Our ability to make some progress in the face of all that information was misinformation was pretty good. The revolution starts now.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking with environmentalist Bill McKibben. So let's, just in a hypothetical world, let's chalk up right now Keystone as a victory, a check mark in your column.
Well, a very temporary victory, yes.
Let's consider it temporary enough to move on to the next battle. What's next for 350.org?
We're going to spend a lot of this year working with others on this question of whether or not the fossil fuel industry deserves subsidies or not from the federal government. They're the richest industry on the planet, so they're not in monetary need of subsidy. And really, if you think about it, there's nothing to subsidize. You give subsidies to things that you don't know how to do yet. We're still learning. We're still sort of early in the learning curve on solar power and things, though it's coming very fast. So it makes sense to subsidize that. It makes no sense to subsidize those things at which we've known how to burn coal for 250 years. What's the subsidy for? It's nothing. It's just a present that you get. Fossil fuel companies give legislators small presents, and then they give them back large presents with our tax money. That's all it is.
One of the things that I wanted to see more action on from larger groups, and I can only blame myself for not getting more involved, we did a piece on Sea Change Radio on the PACE program, which got squashed in Congress, and it seemed to die a small, sad, quiet death.
I think it's coming back. This is this program that would allow people to...
It stands for our listeners, it stands for the Property Assessed Clean Energy Act or whatever.
Put on their mortgage, as it were, the energy improvement, solar panels or weatherization or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And the Fannie and Freddie had essentially blocked it. For bad reasons. But in many communities, it's making a comeback. I know in my state in Vermont, in fact, we just voted in town meeting earlier this month to make ourselves a PACE district. And now now the state and feds will be able to do some of that work here in our town, and I think in many other towns in Vermont, and I think increasingly in other places around the country, which is very good news. It's a very smart, obvious program. And in places where it's remained in place, it's generated lots of employment over the last few years. I saw the data recently for Sonoma County, which kept a PACE program going despite the federal problems. And the amount of investment in renewable energy and home weatherization and things was far higher than in the surrounding counties, and hence job creation and everything that goes with it.
Well, it was very frustrating to see it squashed for seemingly just a turf war, really. If listeners are interested, they can go to the Sea Change Radio archives and listen to our interview with the founder of the PACE program, Cisco DeVries. Bill McKibben, you wrote that I've read that the environmental movement is a quiet revolution begun by ordinary people with the stuff of our daily lives. And you've inspired a lot of ordinary people to do some extraordinary things, and I want to thank you for your service to our planet. And thanks for being on Sea Change Radio.
Well, my pleasure, and thank you for all you're doing, Alex. It's a real pleasure to get to talk to you, and I'll look forward to the next time.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Eddie Harris, Jimmy Cliff, and Steve Earle. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.